and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Iowa just as the caucuses get underway and speak with Erica Greider, a senior editor at the Texas Monthly, where she has an article, The Field Guide to Ted Cruz, 10 Tips for Figuring Out the Wacko Bird. She joins us to discuss the increasingly acrimonious competition between the two Republican frontrunners, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, who just called Cruz a liar. And although Cruz is on the record calling Trump terrific, we will examine this polarizing figure who is either loved or hated and assess his chances of either becoming the next president of the United States or a laughingstock. Then, with Adele and other recording artists serving notice to Trump, Huckabee, and other Republican presidential hopefuls for copyright infringement, we will speak with William Hochberg, an attorney specializing in music and media law, whose clients have included award-winning recording artists, songwriters, producers, film composers, record labels, and music publishers. We will discuss the rules for using recorded music at political rallies and what rights artists have when they feel their image and reputation is being damaged by politicians they do not support and, in some cases, despise. Then finally, we will look into the epidemic of gun violence in Chicago, with 292 people shot and 50 killed in January alone, which is double the number of shootings compared to last year. Craig Futterman, a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School, who was the founder of the Civil Rights and Police Accountability Projects in Chicago, joins us to examine what is behind these alarming statistics that do not include officer-involved shootings. And before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the UCLA Hammer Forum tomorrow night, Tuesday, February the 2nd at 7:30 p.m., Greening the Gas Tank. We'll be looking into the political, technological, economic, and manufacturing issues involved in getting more non-polluting vehicles on the road. We'll hear from Consumer Watchdog President Jamie Court, environmentalist Ed Begley Jr., and the leading automotive journalist Paul Eisenstein. Again, Greening the Gas Tank tomorrow, Tuesday, February the 2nd at 7:30 p.m. Join me at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood, free and open to the public. And joining us now from Iowa is Erica Greider, who's a senior editor at the Texas Monthly, who from 2007 to 2012 covered Texas as a Southwest correspondent for The Economist, to which she is still a contributor. She is the author of Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, and has an article at the Texas Monthly, The Field Guide to Ted Cruz, 10 Tips for Figuring Out the Wacko Bird. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erica Greider.
Thank you for having me.
And the wacko bird, of course, refers to what John McCain described the junior senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, as. But in this increasingly acrimonious competition between the two front runners in Iowa, Donald Trump just called Ted Cruz a liar. And, of course, unfortunately for Cruz, he's gone on the record calling Trump terrific. So how's this thing working out there on the ground?
Well, we'll find out tonight. So the caucuses have just begun here in Iowa, and it'll be a few hours until the results are known on both sides. But the last poll from the Des Moines Register had Trump leading by about 5 points and Cruz coming in second. Rubio coming in third with about 21%, so behind those two significantly. So there's a lot of suspense. I think everyone expects it will be Cruz or Trump. But the Iowa caucus, as you know, is unpredictable because it's an unusual, anomalous process where people change their minds at the last minute occasionally.
So in terms of your field guide to Ted Cruz, 10 Tips for Figuring Out the Wacko Bird, he's obviously a very polarizing figure, is either loved or hated. And you write in your article that he's either going to become the next president of the United States or a laughingstock. That's a pretty extreme choice there, wouldn't you say?
It is pretty stark, but, people, I think, have pretty extreme views of him. As you say, he's polarizing, but I think that if he loses, even if he loses just tonight in Iowa, if so, he'll have lost to Trump, one presumes. And, Trump, nobody has any idea what to make of Trump as a phenomenon, right? So it would seem a little extreme to say that Iowa is this important or to say that his career hinges on how he does in this nominating contest, but he's got so many enemies within his own party and on the other side, who just think that he's an extremist, a crazy person, a maniac, a bomb thrower, and, would not be sympathetic to his travails.
Well, in my opinion, for what it's worth, Erica, I think Trump doesn't want to be president. He wants to win the presidency. So if that's the case, what about Cruz? Does he really want this job?
Yeah, I think he does. I think he's been wanting this job for... Can we go back to your opinion? That's interesting. I mean, if Trump wants to win the presidency but not be the president, how would that play out? I mean, that seems...
Well, it feels more like an ego exercise than somebody that is passionately driven to fix his perceives as the problems of this country that need addressing.
I totally agree with that. But I mean, do you think he would, win the general election then drop out, or become president, get sworn in, then drop out, or?
No, I think if he won the presidency, it would be a catastrophe for all of us, if you want me to be honest. But I think he would go ahead and be president. I mean, it's certainly probably a more exalted residence than Trump Tower. And Air Force One is a little bit bigger than Trump's plane.
Oh, man. That's what really troubles me. I think that him being president, in a way, it would be kind of reassuring to think he'll be president, but then he'll quit. But him actually being president, serving as president, I think would be catastrophic for the nation, for perhaps the world. I mean, I agree. And so with Cruz, what's been interesting to watch here in Iowa is that I've been covering him since the beginning of his political career, which isn't that long. He was elected to the Senate in 2012, and he's always been polarizing. But in this race, he's emerged as the only one of the candidates running on the Republican side who has been able to get any traction against Trump. And since I think Trump is like a DEFCON 5 scenario, I think that's, got to be counted in Cruz's favor that he might be able to beat Trump.
But apparently, though, since Trump enlisted Sarah Palin and Joe Arpaio and has Jerry Falwell Jr. stumping for him, the indications are, at least from what one reads, is that he's gone down in the polls, that Trump has actually done an end run around him. Go ahead.
Well, what's even more strange is that he's attracted some support from these people like Sarah Palin and Jerry Falwell Jr., who one wouldn't consider especially serious thought leaders of the American right. But Cruz has also been being attacked from all sides by the Republican establishment, by his rivals like Mike Huckabee, who won the Iowa caucus in 2008, and just sort of being sniped at, which, makes sense because they're competing, but it's also... There's this sort of emerging sense in the past few weeks that a lot of Republican leaders, and some have said so explicitly, including Bob Dole, who was the nominee in, 1996? That if it comes right down to it, that they'd rather have Trump than Cruz, because they think that Trump is less ideological and more open to negotiations, which I think is frankly delusional.
Well, then, since you spent some time with Cruz, explain who he really is in those terms. He is ideological, but... What's the difference?
Well, for context, I'm sure most of your listeners know this, but as a journalist based in Texas, most of the people I cover are Republicans. The state hasn't elected a Democrat to high office for 20 years. So I've seen Cruz emerge from a state with a Republican tradition that I've been covering for a long time, and I think he's consistent with that tradition. So he's conservative, but he's not as rabid as national media views of the state would probably suggest. He's probably more of a fiscal conservative than a social conservative. He's not really big on culture wars. I suppose the biggest distinction with him compared to, say, Rick Perry, who is also pretty familiar to a national audience, would be that Cruz has a background as a constitutional lawyer, as an appellate lawyer, and so he's much more, he's very much a constitutionalist conservative, and you hear him talk about it all the time, including even here in Iowa. He's been talking about the Constitution like it's the scripture.
So, again, I'm speaking with Erica Greider, who is a senior editor at the Texas Monthly, where she has an article, The Field Guide to Ted Cruz, 10 Tips for Figuring Out the Wacko Bird. So in terms, though, of coming from a conservative state and winning the election as an underdog for the U.S. Senate, he's had a fairly meteoric career. And, of course, people make comparisons to Barack Obama, who was a backbencher, a junior senator, and suddenly became president of the United States. But so why, then, is he so hated?
Well, that's a great question, one I've kind of struggled with quite a bit. I might not be the best person to say, because for a lot of people, there's just a sort of visceral aversion. I mean, people just report they don't like him, they just don't like the guy. And then they'll kind of offer a reason if pressed, but it's always kind of a vague reason, like, he seems dishonest, he's duplicitous, he's a liar, which, I guess they can make that case, but he's also a politician running for president. So, I mean, really, they're all saying stuff on the campaign stump that we wouldn't take as literally what they always think or what they always mean. I think there's some level of maybe just his voice or his face is not appealing to people. But then I think with people who know him, because there's been this cluster of people in Congress and people from the Bush campaign from 2000. He worked for George W. Bush when Bush was running for president, who've said, oh, I never liked him. He's a bad guy. He's a bad actor. And people in Congress who've said he's a bad colleague. He's irresponsible. He's reckless. He caused the government shutdown. He's used these extreme tactics. And so Cruz has sort of cast it as the fact that these people, these corrupt Washington elites, this cartel, he calls it the cartel, are so opposed to me should tell you all you need to know about who I am. They're opposed to me because I've been fighting them. And, you know, with regard to Obamacare, I had, in 2013, you recall, he had an effort to convince the Senate to defund Obamacare. The House, which had a Republican majority, did so, and the Senate did not, and a lot of Senate Republicans were upset that Cruz had pushed the issue so far, had clamored for it so much. In that case, I was not really sure, you know, how to assign the ethical blame, I guess. But I gotta say, Ian, I mean, right now in Iowa, watching the Republican establishment tacitly support Trump over Cruz, it seems to me to corroborate his critique in a way that I haven't quite considered it corroborated before.
Well, but clearly, if Trump wasn't running, Cruz would be way ahead, wouldn't he?
Well, yeah, that's what I would think. I mean, it seems we've seen polls both in the state and in the nation that show Cruz is the second choice of Trump supporters. So one would think that if one of them got out of the race, then the other one would get most of their supporters. But I don't know if that's a widely held opinion. It seems like people think that Trump is just created so much confusion, they don't know what to think about the race, and there's a sense among certain candidates' camps, especially Jeb Bush's camp, that if the field winnows and narrows, and Jeb can just get a one-on-one showdown with Trump, then Jeb will emerge ahead. So, which, again, I don't see the evidence.
Right. Well, that's what's so extraordinary is that, you know, there was a meeting of the Koch brothers and their network this last weekend near here in Palm Springs. And apparently there was a lot of angst and anguish going on there about Trump and who to get behind. But nobody's really coalesced in terms of the big money behind anybody yet, have they?
No, and I guess they might wait till after New Hampshire, because Iowa's caucus is so idiosyncratic that I think, you know, actually it's kind of funny, because for all the interest in the caucus, if Cruz or Trump wins, it'll be discounted as reflecting the inherent anomalies of Iowa, and everyone will go to New Hampshire. And then, you know, if somebody comes in second in New Hampshire, Jeb or Rubio or Chris Christie or John Kasich, then there'll be this sense of, oh, well, that was the real person. That's the real person who should be the winner. But, I mean, I don't know why Trump is not being seen as somebody who could actually win the nomination. He's like the front runner in every state poll and around the nation.
So when you mentioned earlier about Trump's stand in the House on Obamacare and in the Senate with his sort of what many call a faux filibuster, that has not endeared him, right? I mean, Grover Norquist, as you say in your article, said that Cruz pushed House Republicans into traffic and wandered away. Is that that's a pretty widespread feeling that this guy's grandstanding?
It is. And even after I put out that article that we're talking about, I got a couple of notes from people who were focused on that point saying, well, essentially, if it was a doomed cause, wasn't his plan just to win by losing to grandstand? And, you know, I'm of two minds about that. You recall the filibuster that Wendy Davis did in Texas, right, against the abortion law?
Right, and now she's gone public with her regrets about that, or what she should have done, right?
Yeah, well, as far as the campaign, I guess, she ran for governor the following year and did not win. But after the filibuster, you know, there was a sort of celebration and this great sort of wave of support for her for standing and speaking out for Texas women and for speaking out against this law. And even though her effort was equally doomed, I mean, she did succeed in the filibuster, I mean, running out the clock, but then what happened was that Governor Perry, you know, just called them back into special session. And so then told them to pass the bill, and they did. And so the bill is now law. And that was a predictable outcome. But in that case, I think, like most observers, I felt that, I mean, I guess my feelings would depend on the nature of the grandstanding, right? But in this case, it was an arduous thing she did. She was speaking for her constituents. I mean, she's got the right to do that. She's a state senator. And with Cruz, too, I felt that, you know, he's a new senator. He was not in Congress at the time the law was passed. He campaigned promising to fight Obamacare. So he's, you know, representing people who voted for him for that reason, presumably. And for him to offer this case or make this case is well within his rights as a senator. And as a constituent, I was not bothered by it. But there was certainly this angry reaction from Republicans in the Senate, especially.
So, in terms of what's happening there on the ground as these caucuses begin now in Iowa, my understanding is that there's a bit of a flap going on about some of the mailers that Cruz sent out, where they're using pretty sophisticated data. And it's basically these report cards about what your neighbors are going to do to sort of shame you into joining your neighbors. And essentially, they use the neighbors' information, but they don't necessarily – the content, it doesn't necessarily reflect the neighbors' positions. But they're meant to influence, obviously, the votes via, peer pressure. So is that backfiring? One would think it would.
I don't think it really has backfired at this point. It'd be hard to say, but I think, Rubio's campaign had sent a very similar mailer, which emerged after the Cruz mailer emerged. And previous candidates, especially in Iowa, have done this. And I, as a Texan, I'm not quite sure how Iowans understand the norms of participation and how they understand their responsibilities. Of course, we've got a very low turnout state, and in Iowa, not only do they have this elaborate deliberative process with all these candidates spending so much time here, but they have a public process that most states don't have. So if you go to the Democratic caucus, it's literally you go stand in the corner for the candidate you prefer, and people try to convince you to come to their corner, which is pretty public and more public than a mailer saying your neighbors voted in the caucus last time around. So I think that the similarity between the mailers, the fact that they've been done before, it seems like it's been a bit of a flap because certainly – as a national observer, international observer, we don't see that kind of behavior or that kind of mailer. I've never seen a mailer like that in Texas, but I've also never seen a campaign mailer, really. So I think it has been a bit overblown.
So in terms of this competition then between not necessarily the front runners, but the second tier, which is largely led by Marco Rubio, and clearly this is what the Koch brothers, having spent $400 million, still have got they had $889 million in the bank, so they're a little less than halfway through their treasury. They were sort of obviously wondering about who to put their money behind. But in terms of the last debate, there was a moment, of course, where Rubio accused Ted Cruz of saying, You'll say anything to get elected, and that seems to have been, in terms of the Monday morning quarterbacking, that was the takeaway line. What's your sense then of if that's his reputation, and you've covered him very very thoroughly, he may say anything to get elected, but what do you think he really believes? Going back to the question about what really you think propels him short of ambition.
I think we would see him taking a conservative approach to fiscal issues. I think we'd see him taking a sort of centrist line on foreign policy. Actually, he's probably between, we think about Rand Paul and John McCain on the foreign policy spectrum on the Republican side. He's probably in the center of those two. He's probably less hawkish than Rubio, I think, who's got quite a few neocons in his circle. I think we would see him not put a ton of focus on social issues. I mean, he's been talking about religious liberty quite a bit on the trail and calling for an investigation into Planned Parenthood, but I think his framing of that as a constitutional issue, religious liberty, constrains the kinds of issues he'd be able to pursue. So actually, with Huckabee kind of sniping at him, one of the reasons has been that Cruz was asked about gay marriage and whether he would prioritize, I don't know what the word would be, re-illegalizing or re-banning or striking down the decision that legalized gay marriage by striking down the bans. And Cruz said that his priority is going to be all the Constitution. And so for Huckabee, it's not going to sound like a very strong statement to Democrats who think that Cruz is a theocrat, but for someone like Huckabee, who's a former pastor and is very focused on social issues, that's a sign of Cruz being doctrinally unsound and not committed enough to pursuing his religious beliefs in public office.
In spite of his father being I believe he's a Dominionist, but
yeah, he is, you know. And to me, looking at those, this is kind of speculative, and I don't know any of these people on a personal level, but I think that Ted Cruz seems like Ivanka Trump to me. I mean, in both cases, you've got a child who's more, seems more level-headed, more temperate, more even-keeled than their bombastic, volatile fathers. And I think that's not an uncommon thing to see. You know, Cruz, of course, has embraced his father's role in the campaign. He's brought him to a number of events. I think his father's going to be at a caucus tonight. But I don't look at Rafael Cruz and think that that's the sort of what Ted Cruz is like behind the mask.
So just in closing, Ted Cruz is not going to go out and carpet bomb the world, in your opinion?
No, I think actually he would be a fairly decent president. And I think one thing that even Democrats might find reassuring is that if he is president, he will be constrained by the Constitution. I mean, he clearly knows the Constitution very well, so his capacity for overreach would be quite limited. But do I have time to ask you about, how do you see him?
Well, I worry about people who, I think this, to some extent, the charge that he will say anything to get elected is a valid one. Not that they all, you know, aren't making promises, and I think that's why Trump is doing so well, that he seems like somebody that he doesn't even tell you what the hell he's going to do. He doesn't tell you anything, you know.
Right.
So I'm just afraid of blind ambition, to quote the title of one of John Dean's books.
Do you think that compared to Rubio, I mean, Rubio in that debate that you mentioned...
Well, that's true. Rubio, you're right about the neocons. He actually, I find him a little scarier, much scarier. So,
and he also, you know, he totally flipped out on immigration. I mean, his position now is Cruz's from 2013, and he's blaming Cruz for saying anything to get elected, but he just blatantly flip-flopped on his stated support for a path to citizenship, which no one seems to be taking him to task for in the same way. It's
right.
Funny, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Well, all's fair in love and war, I guess, and politics.
Yeah, I guess so. We'll see what happens.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it, Erica.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Erica Greider, who's a senior editor at the Texas Monthly, where she has an article, The Field Guide to Ted Cruz, 10 Tips for Figuring Out the Wacko Bird. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Adele and a number of other recording artists are suing Republican presidential hopefuls for copyright infringement.
Is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is William Hochberg, who's an attorney specializing in music and media law, whose clients have included award-winning recording artists, songwriters, producers, film composers, record labels, music publishers, and other creative talent. With more than 20 years of experience, he has handled nearly all aspects of the music and media industries and writes on music and media-related topics for The Atlantic, Wired, and many other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hochberg.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And it does seem that there's an explosion of litigation, or at least threats of litigation, from a number of very prominent recording artists who feel that their music is being stolen, essentially, by these mostly Republican presidential candidates. So is this a new phenomenon, or is it just because this is such an overheated campaign season?
Yeah. Well, it's not new. And it's mostly threats, as you say, or just expressions of displeasure, sort of shaming, trying to shame the Trump train or others. But as far as actual litigation, it's few and far between. The only one of these cases, or the most prominent one of these cases that I know of that actually turned into litigation, was back in 2009 when Jackson Browne, objected to John McCain's use of his song Running on Empty in a campaign commercial and brought a lawsuit and stuck to his guns. And it's a published opinion, one of the few. And the court sided with Jackson Browne that it was a violation, it was likely to have been. I mean, it was procedurally a little complicated. It was likely, the court said, that if it had gone all the way to trial, that it would have been McCain's use of the song, connecting that song with his campaign, would have been a violation of his Jackson Browne's right of publicity and possibly and copyright, and as well a trademark right. And so they settled that case promptly after the court gave its interim opinion on that. So most of it doesn't actually go into litigation. Usually it's it's either a cease and desist letter or just a phone call, like Steven Tyler apparently made to Donald Trump. And Adele recently, I think just in the last day or so, has expressed her displeasure with Trump using the song. I haven't heard that the Rolling Stones have made any noises about it. But it's usually because legally, unless it's the Trump team is pretty astute and clever in what they're doing, and legally, what they're doing is that they're getting what's called a performance license from the Performing Rights Societies, which are ASCAP, BMI, and CSEC in the United States. And they pay a fee, and it's for Trump and that campaign, it's a very modest fee, probably, by their standards. And it gives them the right to use 20 million plus songs, but they can only use them live at these events. They can't take the song and put it on a TV ad or fix it in some way on something that would require additional licensing. So they're very clever, because they're probably within the law to have music playing in the venue. They get these. In fact, ASCAP even encourages campaigns to get these licenses. I mean, we represent a lot of musicians and songwriters, and well, although we represent the estate of Bob Marley, I have to say that we haven't seen the Trump campaign using I Shot the Sheriff or Buffalo Soldier. If they did, they'd probably get a cease and desist letter, most certainly. So there are some artists. Sorry?
I was going to say, so just to touch on Jackson Browne, though, that case, because it didn't go to court, is not used as precedent then, right?
No, it went to court. It just didn't go to trial.
Didn't go to trial.
But it actually is precedent, and it's a pretty scary one for those who are thinking about using music in advertisements. It's like what I'm talking about now is that was a case where McCain folks took Running on Empty and actually put it into an ad. Now, if you put it into an ad on TV, that's a different story. But what Trump, then you are going to look at that published opinion, and your lawyers are going to tell you you're in trouble. You know, but it's funny, because you have to ask yourself, why would that campaign, why do they use, you know, obviously you know why they want to use music. I mean, there was an article in Wired not too long ago talking about the actual dopamine release that happens when someone listens to a song, you know, that's a hit song that they remember. To have that association, that buzz, that excitement associated with a campaign is a great thing. But then you weigh that against then the artist who performed the song and the writer who wrote it goes public and says that they don't, you know, that they don't approve of it or that they detest you. And yet, you know, like REM did after Trump and Cruz used End of the World as We Know It. But they make, I don't know, they make a calculation, I guess, that, hey, we, you know, the Trump train keeps a rolling. You know, right. Steven Tyler calls and they don't, doesn't seem to bother them. They just stopped using it, but they use other things. And the train keeps rolling and it's trampling over the rights of the musicians and songwriters to the extent that if they're using that song as, well, it's not really trampling over the rights of the musicians and songwriters. If it's just music that's playing in the background before the campaign, but before the before the speech. But if it becomes walk-on music, like Sarah Palin had done back in the McCain last presidential, when he ran for president, and she had Hart's song Barracuda as her walk-on music. I mean, she played it every time she walked on stage, and they called her Sarah Cuda. That's different. But if you're, you know, if he's just playing the music in the background, that seems to be okay. Where it crosses the line is when you start using it as a trademark, or you use it as it suggests an endorsement, and repeatedly you're using it as walk-on music. And that may be where Trump is going to get in trouble. But again, it's interesting that he doesn't seem to care that his supporters, Trump supporters, don't seem to mind that this music that they love, the people who wrote it and many times detest Trump and are public about it. They just keep on rolling along with the Trump train.
And again, I'm speaking with William Hochberg, an attorney specializing in music and media law. Well, in regards to RAM and Michael Stipe told Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, who played, as you mentioned, It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine at rallies. This is just quoting Michael Stipe, which I can't actually quote him thoroughly because we get a huge FCC fine. Go F yourselves, the lot of you, you sad, attention-grabbing, power-hungry little men. Do not use our music or my voice for your moronic charade of a campaign. So that leads us to the really important questions here, which is about, you know, what recourse do artists have about protecting their image and their reputations from politicians who are usurping their material, and particularly in the case of politicians that you not only do not support, but in Michael Stipe's case, that you despise.
Yeah, well, you know, again, the law, the way that the law and the contractual relations between ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC and the writers currently exists, they have some latitude, these campaigns, to use. They get these campaign licenses, they pay ASCAP and BMI, and they have some rights to use that. Where they cross over the line and start using the song as kind of a trademark or like a walk-on music, that's when the artists can go after them. Or if they use the song in a commercial, that's when they can go after them. You don't see that, right? You see Bernie Sanders with America, which is a great use of a song. That Paul Simon, you know, obviously he wrote it, and obviously he approved, because it's that required a license more than an ASCAP or BMI license. But to your question, so as Jackson Browne did, I mean, there's two things. I mean, if anyone uses a campaign uses music beyond just playing in the background before the speech, uses it as walk-on music, or as in the Jackson Browne case, puts it into a political ad, you know, with running on empty, or Chuck DeVore against Barbara Boxer taking the song All She Wants to Do Is Dance and turning it into All She Wants to Do Is Tax, then you can go after them. I mean, they're using your song in a commercial. That's different.
Sure.
I think that ASCAP and BMI ought to look at their policies a little more, and I think some artists are not going with ASCAP and BMI anymore. They have a huge number of, they've got a, you know, millions of writers, and they've got 20 million plus songs between them, ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC. But Pharrell, for example, you will never hear Pharrell's music at one of those campaigns because he's opted out of ASCAP and BMI. You won't hear Happy or Get Lucky by Pharrell at any campaign unless he wants it, because he's gone with another newer company called Global Music Rights that Irving Azoff started, the music mogul, within the last couple of years. And so you are seeing some going with other options, and I'm not saying that they're going there just because of this political situation, but you would never see anybody who's with a different organization that doesn't allow this kind of a, that only does direct licensing. What ASCAP and BMI does is sort of Walmart type of licensing, if you will. Any you know, for all who come, they get the use of all this music. So, to your question, what can they do? Well, if they use your, you know, the Republicans are pretty, and the Democrats too, are very savvy about how they can use, what they can get away with, and they can use it as background music. But when they cross over that line into using it to identify with the artist, then it becomes something else. Now, some, then it becomes potentially actionable.
Well, now, presumably that's the case with Adele's song, Hello, which Mike Huckabee, he released a parody video cut to Adele's song, Hello, and she apparently, or at least her team, shut him down. And, of course, he then went on Fox News and accused Adele of being very petty about the video. So, but let's look into the, in this, in the last couple of minutes here. Let's look into the history of this. Is this a new phenomenon, using popular music for political rallies and for political commercials?
Yeah, no. It goes way back, and it's really interesting. You know, there's a I want to give a shout out to the Smithsonian, which has a an album, a collection of these songs. If you Google Smithsonian political campaign songs, a guy named Oscar Brand sang them all, going all the way to, back to Washington. And some of them are hilarious. The things, the mudslinging that went on, Tippi Canoe and Tyler II. I guess now we have Adele and Journey and Tyler II. We have Steven Tyler now. But back in those days, you had just hilarious songs that were custom made for the candidates. That practice seems to have stopped with Carter, I think, was, I'm told, is the last one that actually had a song written for him. Now it's you use a hit song. But there were cases going back. There are some cases of the first one that I know of where you have objections to the use of music is with Hello Dolly. Hello Dolly was, of course, the hit Broadway musical, and Barry Goldwater, back in his 1964 campaign, changed Hello Dolly to Hello Barry, and the musical producer, a Democrat, reportedly threatened a copyright infringement action, and Goldwater relented. Then Lyndon Johnson got permission from the same producer, and he came out with Hello Lyndon, and the country welcomed him into the White House with that as his walk-on music. And you've got other many other cases of using music. As I said, the more recently you have the switch from custom-made music, which I wish they would go back to, by the way, because some of those songs are just hilarious and could be hit songs. Like, for instance, This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land, which actually was Woody Guthrie's anthem, which was a socialist anthem, This Land Is Your Land. It's kind of ironic that George H.W. Bush used This Land Is Your Land as his campaign theme when it was written by Woody Guthrie, apparently for the 1948 campaign of Henry Wallace, who was a progressive, if not a socialist, very liberal-leaning.
Sure.
So you have a history of unusual pairings or ironic pairings.
Well, William Huckberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with William Huckberg, who's an attorney specializing in music and media law, whose clients have included award-winning recording artists, songwriters, producers, film composers, record labels, and music publishers. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the epidemic of gun violence in Chicago.
I've got.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Craig Futterman, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. He was previously the director of public interest programs and lecturer in law at Stanford Law School, and he's the founder of the Civil Rights and Police Accountability Projects of the Mandel Legal Aid Clinic, where he specializes in civil rights lawsuits involving police brutality and racial discrimination. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Futterman.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And your city of Chicago has just had an epidemic of gun violence in the month of Chicago, with 292 people shot, 50 killed in January alone, which is double the number of shootings compared to last year, and a 16-year high in terms of a death toll. What can you tell us that to explain this outbreak of violence?
So, I don't have any ready or easy explanation for it. But I have to start with, of course, it's horrible. Anytime you see so many people killed, it's offensive to all of us and hurtful. These are real people's lives. At the same time, I just have to really sound some caution that not to read too much into any single month's data. Crime and violence have gone up and down, and a month's data, and even sometimes a year's data, to read a broader trend is often a grave mistake. We were here in Chicago just a few years back, and there were media headlines about this massive uptick in violence in Chicago, and it turned out to be a minor blip in the middle of a strong and long downward trend. So I don't have any particular explanation for why in this single month shootings went up so much as compared to months in previous years. It could be anything from particular rifts among particular people and or violence among gangs to it was much warmer this month of January than it's been in a month in January in an awfully long time. But I don't want to claim to have to know the answer to this.
But we spoke, of course, Craig, fairly recently in the aftermath of the shooting of Laquan McDonald, the 70-year-old who was shot down in the middle of the street.
Yes.
And we all saw that. And we talked quite a bit about the epidemic of police violence, if you will, and what's being done about it. And Mayor Rahm Emanuel is clearly still in the hot seat. But these statistics for the month of January, 292 people shot with 50 killed, they don't reflect police or officer-involved shootings, do they?
No, that doesn't count the officer, or I don't believe that counts the officer involved shootings, or police have shot people as well. And there have been instances also in the month of January, and I don't know how many offhand. There's one, or actually two, that strike me as in particular. And there was a police shooting early in January, and actually a pretty scary shooting that involved an emotionally disturbed young man and an older woman, his neighbor, who police officer now says he accidentally shot and didn't see her. So police shootings are still something that continue to go on in Chicago, and that's one of the things that the Department of Justice is also doing an investigation into.
So then, in contrast, then, I imagine there's a lot more shootings that aren't police officer involved, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So the shootings you just mentioned, that there were, as you just mentioned, there were 50 people who were killed, that and not killed by police officers in Chicago.
So where does the mayor stand now, just to sort of follow up on the Laquan McDonald shooting? I can't understand why he came out against Spike Lee's film, Chirac. Apparently that term, which I think is a pretty appropriate one, really, blending Chicago with Iraq in terms of if you got 292 people shot in a month, that's certainly, I think, higher than probably U.S. casualties are, certainly in the various wars that the U.S. is in, and even going back to the Iraq War. So is he sort of – does he have a siege mentality? What's going on with Mayor Emanuel?
Well, the mayor still remains in the hot seat in Chicago, and indeed there was a recent poll that was published in the Chicago Tribune today that a majority of people and a majority of people do not have faith or confidence in him as a leader. And in particular, they found that the lack of confidence emerges primarily as a result of his, and there was a poll about this, of his mishandling and the city's mishandling of the police shooting of Laquan McDonald. So he remains in the hot seat and under a lot of pressure. Many people still continue to call for his resignation. He also has, though, an opportunity. I mean, so he's, you know, thus far has been very much in reactive mode and reactive to crises. And there is a real opportunity that exists for him right now to get in front of this and to be proactive rather than just to be seen as responsive. Like, he's done a number of good things in being responsive, in increasing, for example, training for police officers to work with people who are emotionally disturbed. But rather than just to implement something like that, which is a wonderful reform, in reaction to unnecessary shooting of mentally ill people, there's really an opportunity for him to get in front of this and to do things that have long needed to be done to address police impunity in Chicago, to particularly address the impunity when it comes to the abuse of Chicago's most vulnerable populations, particularly in the Black community. And here's an opportunity for him to get in front of this, not simply to wait for the Department of Justice, and not simply wait for the next crisis, the next police shooting, and the next upheaval to be reactive. If he wants to be a mayor that people will trust and that all people will ultimately trust, it will start by taking real leadership. He's done something that I want to give him credit for, which is acknowledging the systemic problems that exist. Never has that happened before in Chicago's history in present terms. That's the first step toward any kind of change, a little bit of honesty. He now needs to maintain that honesty and to actually address the underlying issues that have allowed his officers, and these are his officers, the minority of whom have abused people in the Black community for so long and continue to do so with impunity.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Futterman, a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School and the founder of the Civil Rights and Police Accountability Project in Chicago. And, of course, Mayor Emanuel and many others, including the head of the FBI, have talked about what they call the Ferguson effect, meaning that police aren't doing their jobs because they're afraid of being on camera and being vilified. So apparently Mayor Emanuel has suggested that that may be a part of this spike in violence. He said that some of his officers have gone fetal, meaning they're curled up in the fetal position out of the fear that close scrutiny of their actions justified or not would land them in trouble. And there was also a departmental audit that came out last month showing that Chicago police officers have been deliberately damaging their dashboard cameras in their patrol cars. So what do you make of that explanation?
Yeah, I don't buy it. And I mean, and when you think about it, at the end of the day, it's preposterous. If the argument is that if police officers are held accountable, if police officers are subject to public scrutiny, murders will go up. That makes absolutely no sense at all. And indeed, it's contradicted by all empirical data that exists. When there is greater police accountability, there is far greater police trust in police, and police are far more effective. And first and foremost, any police officer who doesn't want to do their job because they will be out of fear and doesn't want to do their job and won't act as a police officer because they're subjected to scrutiny and that their role will be subject to scrutiny, has no business being a police officer. We give police police officers a tremendous amount of powers, and they need to have those powers. And these power, the power includes taking people's liberty, using force against people, shooting and even killing people when necessary. And along with each and every one of those powers goes an accountability to the public. And so the bottom line, that comes with the territory, and something that I'm just not sympathetic to is when an officer says, oh, the public is looking over my shoulder. Oh, there could be video that shows that I did something wrong, so I'm not going to do anything at all. Good riddance, I say, to those officers, because we have lots of great officers who are honest and who are ethical and who welcome our scrutiny. And indeed, our scrutiny really, you know, when there's videos of officers doing their jobs, camera can be an officer's best friend. It can show when people make up things against an officer. It can be the best friend of even prosecutors when people have lied. So if an officer is doing his or her job and an officer is honest, an officer has integrity, that camera helps them. And not just camera, but public scrutiny helps them, and they should welcome that public scrutiny, because ultimately the police and the public come from the same place, and the most fundamental principle of policing is that the police are the public and the public are the police, and the police are ultimately accountable to each and all of us.
So given that the spike in violence in Chicago is highly unlikely to be attributed to the police being subject to the Ferguson effect and going fetal, as Mayor Rahm Emanuel has suggested, other factors, I imagine, are just ones that have been identified before, but I believe that these gangs that are responsible for most of the shooting are splintering, and of course there's the long ongoing proliferation of handguns and other sophisticated automatic weapons, the destruction of low-income housing projects, and yep. Of course the pervasive poor economy and high unemployment. So walk us through what you think is, if indeed there are other effects that I haven't mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I think each of the things that you mentioned are real causes of violence and causes of violence in Chicago. And, you know, I might even add then the closing of many neighborhood schools in Chicago as well, that upset and it moved also people and young folks together from rival gangs and caused also young folks to have to cross rival gang territory at times as well, just as the tearing down of public housing and disruption of communities, and also, to be frank, disruption even of stable drug markets where at least territory being charted out, and by changing that territory, it created new conflicts as well. But I don't, again, as I started this conversation in the beginning, and not to mention then just issues of poverty, issues of lack of opportunity, and issues of abandonment, and lack of programs and lack of alternatives for so many people who live in Chicago. But as I started, I also don't want to blow up this single month or even a single year and pretend that we have a trend that really hasn't been proven, because indeed the trend, not just Chicago, but nationwide, has largely been now for more than a decade that violence has been going, community violence has been going down. And my fear is that, you know, that these sort of chicken little sky is falling, violence goes up, becomes then an excuse for things like these fetal arguments, an excuse for stop and frisk, an excuse for police brutality, an excuse for a lack of police accountability, and a way to, and I've seen the script before, where we point to this then to divert our attention away from fundamental problems that we have actually a chance and a real chance to address in Chicago. And I think it's time that we focus on those problems. And those at the center right now include real issues of police accountability, a code of silence, a lack of honesty, and institutional denial. And we have a chance to address each and every one of those problems here in Chicago right now. If we do, that's going to impact violence as well, because that's going to establish greater trust in the police, and that's going to make us far more effective at solving crime. That's where I think we need to go.
Well, just in the last minute or so then, Craig Federman, what about the broader issue of the war on drugs, because so much of the violence amongst gangs are over turf in terms of selling drugs. And to my mind, from what I know about these gangs, they're basically drug dealing operations, by and large. That's at least what funds them. So surely it's inescapable, isn't it, the war on drugs, in terms of an issue that has to be factored into this mayhem?
Yeah, well, the war on drugs has been an abysmal failure, and its effects have been de facto a war on some of our poor and African-American communities. So we have a war that started in and around 1980, and, you know, at that time we had just about 300,000 people in jail, and we thought that was in jail and prison. We thought that was way too much. And a couple decades later, we have now like 2.3 million and nearly 1 million black folks alone. And so when you think about, though, a war on drugs and its success, though, drugs are equally available and just as cheap now as they were then. But what we have done is incarcerated a whole generation of folks and split up so many families, often for, you know, low level drug crimes, defunded things like treatment and prevention. And, you know, and part of the reality, and one of the things that in terms of just success and just trying to, through a war on drugs, arresting our way out of this problem, something that is just shown, it doesn't work. I worked for a number of years with my students in public housing in Chicago, and we would see these open-air drug markets and kids who worked almost like sweatshop workers, and far from glamorized, and who were arrested all the time, taken off the street. And 20 minutes later, there'd be a new set of kids to replace them. And that's because we put all this money into this aggressive military war on drugs and war on our children, instead of addressing conditions of abandonment and the lack of opportunity in those communities that give people real alternatives. And what we found that actually when we provided some alternatives, like we were able even to create some very low-level, hard sweatshop-like jobs as an alternative that paid minimum wage. And we had some of the veterans from the gangs just lined up, I will take that job over working in this drug trade any day. So the war on drugs has been a far greater cause of crime, violence, and poverty than an answer. And I'm glad to see that it seems that we are beginning to recognize that as a nation and beginning to address, at least just beginning to address, real issues of the cost of mass incarceration of so many people.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Craig Federman.
Thank you so much for having me again, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Craig Federman, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School and the founder of the Civil Rights and Police Accountability Projects at the Mandel Legal Aid Clinic in Chicago. And again, I'd like to invite you to the Ursula Hammer Forum. I'm moderating tomorrow night, Tuesday, February the 2nd at 7:30 p.m., Greening the Gas Tank. We'll be looking into the political, technological, economic, and manufacturing issues involved in getting more non-polluting vehicles on the road. We'll hear from Consumer Watchdog President Jamie Court, environmentalist Ed Begley Jr., and the leading automotive journalist Paul Eisenstein. Again, tomorrow, Tuesday, February the 2nd at 7:30 p.m., Greening the Gas Tank, free and open to the public. Join me in Westwood. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.